You have a favorite band?
I do. In fact, they've been my favorite band since I was about 12 years old, which is a long time now. I never thought that saying that, but it's a long time. I was a fan of this band, really because my youth minister. But man, I loved this band. U2. Everybody heard of a little band called U2, the biggest band in the world, pretty much. They're like one of the only bands that can still sell out stadiums. You know, I did not actually get to see them until they were about, talked about 19 or so. But I fell in love with their first album, which is, they're celebrating this year because it's the 30th anniversary of their album, Joshua Tree. And they made millions and millions and millions. Really, they started, nobody knew who they were until a little thing called Farm Aid. You guys remember Farm Aid? I'm sure you do. And this guy walks on stage, his name is Bono, and he's like, also, you listen to people talk about it, and it was like, he came through the TV set, and he was just singing to me. And after Farm Aid, this band, U2, just blew up. I mean, they were just crazy. I'll never forget the first time I saw them. I've seen them about four times, which, if you know anything about how their tickets, it's a lot of money I've spent on this band. 6/28, so June 28th, 1997, I went to Soldier Field, and I saw them just for 2.5 hours as they just played these huge songs. And it was so funny because they would start a song, and they wouldn't have to finish it. It was like the whole crowd would just finish the song for them. You know, it was one of those moments. I just remember going, man, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. But for 30 years or so now, U2 has protected one song. There's one song that they have protected. It's not Amazing Grace. That was written long before they ever came around. They have not let anyone buy rights to it for commercials, for movies, for anything. They protected this one song, and it was one of my favorite songs ever. It's called Where the Streets Have No Name. And I would sing it for you, but I won't do that. They said why they've protected this one song. They finally let it be played in a commercial, but they didn't take any money for it. And they let it be played in this commercial for the World Cup, which was held in Africa. And it was just this, they just felt like it was this momentous occasion that South Africa was getting the World Cup, and they could allow their song to be played for this because of Nelson Mandela and all this other. But anyway. So they protected this one song, and they said the reason why we protect this song so much is because it is the song that we play to this day that when we start singing it, God walks in the room. And when they played that song, it was amazing. Because they started playing the song, and everywhere you look, hands start raising straight up in the air. People in this concert, majority of the people, were full on worshiping. They just didn't know it. They just had no clue. They had no clue who they were worshiping or what they were worshiping. All they knew is this song drove them to throw their hands in the air in elation and in meditation. And it was an anthem. Do we get this? I don't know. Perhaps it's not U2. Maybe it's Bob Dylan. Maybe it's Elvis. Maybe it's some country star that I don't know about because I don't really listen to country. This is Johnny Cash. Maybe music isn't your thing. Maybe it's a sporting event. You know, I am a pretty big fan of the Buccaneers, and that's terrible because they're terrible usually. I'm also a huge fan of the St. Louis Cardinals, and I don't want to talk about last year. But what is it that you partake in, that you engage in, that you realize you're a part of something bigger than we are, something bigger than us? What is something that you do, something that you just realize, like, this is, I'm part of something. I'm part of something, and maybe I don't understand it all yet, but I'm part of something that's bigger than me. I hope that's how you feel about church and how you feel about the body, your family of believers that we have here. I hope that's your case. But if it's not, that's okay. Because hopefully at some point, in some way, you will make that connection. That you are now part of something that is bigger than anything that we can know. Today's story is that. Pretty much takes us up where our last story left off. And for those of you that were here last week, let me apologize for being a crying, slobbery mess. It's embarrassing. Like, I'm paid to preach. Like, pull it together. For those of you that didn't, you can listen to the recording. It was a hot mess. But that's okay. Because God showed up. I hope that last week that John, when we studied John 11, what really hit home was that we have a Messiah that loves us and feels with us, and that he has the power to undo death. That was the point. That was my point from last week. I know the slides aren't working. Sorry about that. But if you're filling your things in, that's... So here we pick up where that story has left off. And the question that becomes us is, now what? Now what do we do? So if you look at John chapter 12, I really believe that this is a natural response to coming face to face with Jesus and realizing that he is the Messiah. Chapter 12, verse 1. 6 days before the Passover ceremonies began, Jesus arrived in Bethany, the home of Lazarus, the man he had raised from the dead. A dinner was prepared in Jesus' honor. Martha served, and Lazarus sat at the table with him. Then Mary took a 12-ounce jar of expensive perfume made from the essence of nard, and she anointed Jesus' feet with it and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, the one who would betray him, said, "That perfume was worth a small fortune. It should have been sold and the money given to the poor." Not that he cared for the poor. He was a thief and who was in charge of the disciples' funds, and he often took some for his own use. Jesus replied, "Leave her alone. She did it in preparation for my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but I will not be here with you much longer." When all the people heard of Jesus' arrival, they flocked to see him and also to see Lazarus, the man Jesus had raised from the dead. Then the leading priests decided to kill Lazarus too, for it was because of him that many of the people had deserted them and believed in Jesus. Does anything pop off the page to you here? Anything? You can shout it out. Anything? We're timid. This is 6 days before Passover. So it's Passion Week. You guys know Passion Week, right? It's the final, is it or Holy Week, Passion Week, whatever you want to call it. It's the final week of Jesus' death. So this is the day before that starts. Now, you have to understand that when we look at how the people of the time, the Jews, how they counted days, they counted days from sunset to sunset. So, if we look, this would be Saturday night, okay? Well, we say, and so if you look in the Jews, they Sabbath is what day? Saturday. And so Sabbath went from sunset on Friday to sunset on. So therefore, you can put this meal after Sabbath because they all followed Sabbath, right? They're good Jews. And so so this is Sunday evening before Monday, right? This is before Monday, right? And so and then Monday is the day that Jesus comes into town riding on a, and everybody lays branches before him, right? So here's where we are in the timeline. The last 7 days of Jesus' life. All right? So that is what is going on here. Yeah, so that Passion Week chart. So look at verse 2. Look at verse 2. A dinner was prepared in Jesus' honor. Martha served, and Lazarus sat at the table with him. Notice what each person is doing and what Mary is, makes her entrance and starts putting perfume on Jesus' feet. But notice what everybody is doing. Everybody's kind of doing their thing. I think we kind of have these characters down now. Martha is all about serving. Lazarus is all about being a witness because all he's got to do is be like, hey, check it out. I'm alive. And everyone's like, yeah, awesome. Yeah, Jesus did that. And Mary is worshiping. And I think lots of times we read this text and we go, well, Mary's response is the best. Can I twist that a little bit? What if I tell you that how all three were worshiping? They're worshiping in their own way. You know, some of us worship by playing the guitar, playing the piano. Some of us worship, which some of us can't carry a tune. We don't really like singing. We do it anyway. But that's not how we worship. Some of us worship by going out in creation. Maybe we go hunting. Or maybe we go fishing and we look and appreciate God's creation and maybe get some good food on the way. Or maybe we just go for a walk in the woods or a sunset. Or maybe we worship God through hearing. I worship God when, you know, let's be honest, like for me, I'm a preacher. I love preaching. I like listening to preachers. I'm a really bad person to go on a road trip with because I download sermons. I listen to them, which is totally frustrating to people. But that's how I worship. My wife worships by singing. And she's like, can you just ask the band if they'll play Oceans, please? Because she loves, she connects to God through music. How do you worship? It's okay. I think lots of times we try to think like, well, this is how you worship. You get up and you sing songs. And if that's not your thing, that's okay. God made us all differently, right? The scriptures say that God knows every hair on our head. He knitted us together in our mother's womb. He knows us inside and out. He knows us better than we know ourselves, right? He made you a certain way, and he knows how you connect with him. It's okay if you worship in different ways. The point is, who do you worship? I might argue that everything we do can be an act of worship. And if you don't believe me, Look at Romans 12:1. And so, dear brothers and sisters, I plead with you to give your bodies to God because of all he has done for you. Let them be a living and holy sacrifice, the kind he will find acceptable. This is truly the way to worship him. So let everything you do be a sacrifice or an offering to God, and if you do that, he will see that as a true act of worship, right? So if you are building a house for someone out of love and out of worship, then that is worship. If you are shoveling somebody's driveway because they're not able to do it, that is an act of worship. If you give it to God, if you, this is your act of worship, may it be a pleasing sacrifice. May everything you do be with the attitude of glory to God. And if you do it that way, then you, whatever you do, you, to all your might, you will be in a worshipful state. So we have all our things, right? We worship God in different ways. And Lazarus, Martha, and Mary are no different. I think the point that we need to take away with that is that when we realize that Jesus is the Messiah, that our response is to worship him. The story focuses in on Mary, who worships by anointing Jesus' feet with spikenard. Is the actual word. It's an expensive perfume. Look at verse 3. Then Mary took a 12-ounce jar of expensive perfume made from the essence of nard, and she anointed Jesus' feet with it and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance. Spikenard is a plant from India. It's like this plant that they would grind up and, I don't know, they made like some awesome smelling. It was like really, really, really strong and fragrant smelling. The fact that it's made from something in India to get to Jerusalem or Bethany and have to travel the distance of a sea and all that, like that is our first clue that that is expensive stuff. This is really expensive. Whatever comes from India is going to be costly. Does that make sense? And in fact, if you look at your notes, my translation says, or about 300 denarii, right? I don't know if anybody, does anybody's translation say that anywhere? Okay, so a denarii was, or denarii, however you say it, a denarii, I think, is a day's wage for a laborer, right? So let's say we have a day laborer and we pay them $10 an hour for, let's just say, 10 hours, right? So they get paid $10 an hour for 10 hours, which would equal $100, right? Times 300. Steve? $30,000. So we're talking about a $30,000 bottle of perfume here. That's a lot of scratch, right? The text implies that Mary was saving it to anoint Jesus' body, which allows us in on something about Mary. Mary thought that Jesus was going to die, and he was going to do it probably pretty soon. Not like 40 years from now, but soon, because she's saving this really expensive bottle of perfume to anoint his body with. She knew it was coming. She knew Jesus' death was coming, which is crazy because unlike the disciples who were with him every day, day in, day out, they still didn't get this fact. Jesus was going to Calvary. He was going to the cross. He was going to die. Mary got it. Jesus told the disciples many times he was going to die. They still didn't believe it, or they didn't get it. He was the Messiah after all. The disciples still believed that Jesus was going to somehow liberate the Jewish people from the oppression of Rome. So, I believe, overcome with gratitude for her brother, for being the Messiah, Mary takes the perfume that she was saving for his death and cracks it open while he is still here. The perfume, this perfume, a dash is used on the head to anoint a king. Just a dash. Mary poured all over Jesus' feet, as if she knew that it still wasn't good enough for Jesus, for the Messiah. Mary then began to wipe his feet with her hair. In those days, hair was a woman's glory. It was always kept up in public, and to let it down, to use it to wipe somebody's feet. N.T. Wright compares that to a woman hiking her skirt up above her head at a formal dinner party. It's embarrassing. It's not right. It's not proper. And you have to understand this. There's tension in the air at this thing. Martha is thinking, what in the world? The disciples, everybody's embarrassed. So finally, Judas breaks the tension. But let's be honest, it's what everybody was thinking anyway. Verses 5 and 6. The perfume was worth a small fortune. It should have been sold and the money given to the poor. And there's a little note here from John. It says, not that he cared for the poor. He was a thief who was in charge of the disciples' funds, and he often took some for his own use. The disciples never figured out the deal with Jesus, with Judas. They never did. At the Last Supper, the hours before he was betrayed, they still don't get that Judas is the one that's going to turn Jesus in. They just didn't get it. And in fact, John's like, they didn't know that he was being stolen from. They were being stolen from. Judas was taking all his money, and they were all oblivious to it. Interesting to say, like, if you're Jesus, you know everything. You know Judas is stealing from you. You know Judas is going to betray you. Yet you still let him come, even to the Last Supper. Because Jesus knew that Judas had an important role to play. It wasn't the role that Jesus would have liked. That's good news for us, because it allows me to know this. Judas is a pretty awful guy. And yet, Jesus, to the very last day, there would have been hope. If he would have turned and just realized who he was in front of, and who his presence was in the presence of. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if Judas would have just figured it out, that things could have been different. But God knowing, Jesus knowing what was going to happen, allowed it to be anyway. And here's the deal. I am a sinner, and I mess up a lot. But man, I'm glad that God gives me chances over and over and over again. I'm glad that Jesus looks at me over and over and over again and says, your sins are forgiven. So here's Judas voicing what everybody's thinking, and then Jesus kind of snips a little bit, says, leave her. Jesus replied, leave her alone. She did it in preparation for my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but I will not be here with you much longer. Wait. Doesn't Jesus love the poor? Of course he does. Jesus is actually quoting Deuteronomy 15:11 here. You know, Jesus loved to quote the Old Testament, especially in reference to himself. Jesus is not downplaying generosity to the poor, but rather he is pointing toward his impending death. It is coming and coming very quickly. And what is Mary doing? Even though she doesn't realize it, she is anointing his body for that death that comes a week later. So what do we learn about this from anybody? I think something that we learn about Mary, about worship, is that Mary gave her best. Mary gave lavishly. She gave lavishly. I mean, if you own a bottle of perfume that's worth $30,000 or 300 denarii, whatever you want to say, and you are willing to crack it open and pour it on some guy's feet because you believe that he is the Messiah, that is lavish, and that's the best she's got. I don't think there's probably like a $50,000 bottle of perfume waiting for her, right? Mary gives worship in spite of criticism. And now remember, worship's not just singing, right? And I'll tell you this right now. If you are doing the Christian life right, you will be criticized. What are you doing? Why are you giving money to the church? What are you doing? Why are you volunteering so much? Or why are you worried about your neighbors? Or why are you doing all of this? Why do you go and serve with a Sunday school class? What's your deal? Do you realize what you could be doing with the money that you give? Do you realize what you could be doing with the time that you're wasting? Do you realize? And in spite of criticism, Mary gives what she has. She gives her best, and she gives lavishly. And she gives lovingly. Man, can you imagine the feet of Jesus? Jesus walked everywhere he went. Sandals. Nastiness. Dirt roads. And Jesus is sitting there, and Mary falls to her feet, pours this crazy expensive perfume on his feet, and starts wiping it off with her hair. If there's anything we get from today, I pray that that is it, that when we worship in the spirit of Mary, and that we worship by giving our best, by giving lavishly, in spite of criticism and lovingly. There's one little extra part here. It says this. Verses 9 through 11. When all the people heard of Jesus' arrival, they flocked to see him and also to see Lazarus and the man Jesus had raised from the dead. Then the leading priests decided to kill Lazarus too, for it was because of him that many people deserted them and believed in Jesus. You ever think about that? Lazarus died again. I mean, if nobody can escape death except for Jesus, right? And Lazarus died again at some point. The Bible doesn't tell us when. But that's just this crazy. And the thought is that it happened a lot sooner rather than later because the Pharisees are now plotting to kill Lazarus too. Precisely because he loved Jesus. Now here's a thought for this, and it's hard for us to comprehend. But there is more persecution going on in the world right now than has ever happened in the history of man. Christians are dying everywhere you look because of their love of Jesus, because they worship the Messiah. We have a hard time with this because we're so insulated. And for us, like attacking Christianity for us is like when somebody gets ordered to take the Ten Commandments out of a courtroom. And we're like, oh, look, persecution. ISIS is, you guys know what they're doing. You look all over the world and people are dying because of their worship of Jesus Christ. And here's the deal. They worship anyway. There's a story about a missionary named Brother Yoon. It's this, in his book called The Heavenly Man, and it's really a story of his life. And so this book, he recounts this tale, or not a tale, as it happened to him. He was captured by the Chinese government because of being a Christian. And so they were like, well, we're going to have fun with his death. We are going to tie you with a rope around your neck and to a tree branch. And we're going to make you stand on a log. And when you finally give way, you'll hang yourself. Brother Yoon says that he lasted, I forget, 20 hours before he couldn't take it anymore, and he gave way. And the story goes that Brother Yoon blacked out as he fell. And the next thing you know, he knew, he woke up, still with the rope around his neck. And the two guards that were with him, bowing down, crying, and basically worshiping. And Brother Yoon's like, what happened? They said, the moment you gave way, lightning came from the sky and knocked the tree branch down. It struck the tree and you lived. We want to know, we want to worship your God. You had anybody tell you that recently? I don't know what's going on with you, but there's something different about you. Can you tell me what you're all about? What that's all about? Who is this God that you serve? Who is this God that you worship? Where are you in this story? Are you with the shameless Mary worshiping Jesus with everything you got? Risking the wrath of her sister who's doing all the hard work, the anger of the men who perhaps don't quite trust their own feelings when a woman lets her hair down in public, and the sneer of the person who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing? Or are you with the cautious, prudent, reliable Judas, as he must have seemed to most of them, looking after the meager resources of the group with steady or settled income, anxious to provide for their needs and still have something left to give to the poor? Put aside your natural inclination to distance yourself from Judas. After all, even at the last moment, none of the other disciples has suspected him of treachery. Can you see just a glimpse of him as you look in the mirror? Or are you back in the kitchen with Martha? If so, how do you feel about Mary and Judas? And how do you feel about Jesus and what he said? I remember being in Africa. I went there to Kenya on a mission trip in 2012. And my favorite band, U2, we were on a safari after it was over. We went and we served people in the slums of Nairobi. 1 million people in 1 square mile. That's how the slums are packed. And I remember the dusty roads and looking up and seeing there's no street signs. There's nothing. And I remember looking around creation. We woke up at sunset, and I saw an elephant sleeping. And so I was being a dummy. I mean, just, and I made this like really loud elephant noise, right? And then all of a sudden I look, and my sister looks, because my sister's with me. We look, and this whole elephant family wakes up. And they're like all kind of struggle to their knees. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I made them mad. I made them mad. I made them mad. I made them mad. You know, run. But I remember as I was sitting there thinking about my trip and thinking about how amazing God was, I played Where the Streets Have No Name. And I just bawled. I wept. Because, man, God is an amazing God. He is one that's worthy of worship. He created Kenya. He created elephants and giraffes and cheetahs and all that awesome, cool stuff. I see lions. And he also made the people in the slums of Nairobi that had nothing. And he loves them so much that he sent Jesus for them. And I sat there and I listened to Where the Streets Have No Name. And I worshiped. How are you worshiping today? Personal check. Let's all refocus our vision on the one who gives life, the one who gives meaning, the one who can raise people from the dead. Let's give faith to Jesus. Let's give our allegiance to Jesus.